Anthea Butler is an associate professor of religious studies and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania and graduate chair of religious studies. Dr. Butler's research and writing focus on African American religion and history, politics, religion, gender, sexuality, media, and popular culture. She is author of Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Her current projects include a book on race, politics, and evangelicals in the late 20th century, and a book on reading, material religion, and race in the early 20th century for UNC Press. Professor Butler was awarded a Luce ACLS Fellowship for the Religion, Journalism, and International Affairs grant for the 2018-2019 academic year to investigate prosperity, gospel, and politics in the American and Nigerian context. She has also been appointed as a visiting fellow at the Yale Divinity School for the 2019-2020 academic year. To just add a couple notes, Anthea is willing to buy a new wardrobe in the name of research. She will go as far as she needs to. She has a very strong Twitter game that I recommend that you check out, and she also has a love of Cosmo the Cougar. Sorry, you red folks. But we at the Maxwell Institute love her, and we're very happy to have her here at the Mormon History Association. Anthea.
Well, I have to say, thank you so much, Janice. Thank you, Paul Reeve. Thank you to the Smith Pettit Lecture. Because I've always wanted to come to MHA, and sometimes invariably during this time of the year, I'm either out of the country or something happens and I'm not around. So I'm really grateful to be here. The other reason why I'm here actually started in high school, because there was a guy that I played in band with who played the tuba, whose name was Mark, and one day we started talking about religion, and he said to me, "Well, I'm Mormon, but you don't know what that is, and I don't really practice anyway, so I'm a Jack Mormon." And I went, "What is a Jack Mormon? Is this like somebody who jacks Jack in the box? What is this, right?" And so I started reading about Mormonism in high school because I grew up in Texas, and we just didn't have that many people around in South Texas. So this has been sort of a good part of my life where I've been interested personally in Mormonism, and I'm really grateful to be here because I've just had kind of an interesting history with you all, and I think we're going to keep going for some reason. All right, here we go. Newspaper headlines around the country on April 10, 1951, centered around General MacArthur and the war. Many were about General MacArthur's wanting to go across into China and continue the war. The next day, he would actually be fired by the president and then reassigned. But the Salt Lake Tribune obviously had a different cover. It said, "LDS sustains McKay as president." The article's lower byline, as you can see, reads, "President McKay asks for support of saints in the new position." The article then goes on to say, "McKay choked with emotion as he extolled the life of his predecessor, George Albert Smith, told of the heavy responsibilities placed on his shoulders in assuming the leadership of the more than 1 million, and humbly asked for faith and support of his followers." So why today am I going to talk about David Omen McKay? Why choose him? And there's a lot of reasons. When I got asked to do this lecture, I was thinking about doing something else. I went over two or three topics. But the person I'm going to blame for this is Colleen McDaniel, who is sitting right here in the front. We met in Philadelphia, and we had a nice meal together. And she said, "I think you need to look at this new book that's coming out called Confidence Amid Change." And I thought, okay. Tell me some reasons, and we talked about them. We won't go into everything we talked about. But I thought this might be something to look at because it was a time period that I'm particularly interested in because of my writing and evangelicalism. But David O. McKay is also the kind of figure that always intrigues me. He's the kind of figure who spans important generational shifts and how they remove or remain static during a time of change. More broadly put, the excerpts from over the 40,000 pages of his diary, written by Claire Middlemiss, who you see here on the other side, who intrigues me greatly, and I'm going to talk about her in a little bit, represents a record of denominational, social, and political change. It also poses a challenge to all of you who are historians, whether you're academic historians or armchair historians or church historians to go through and read these minutes carefully, as I believe they will challenge some of the present and persistent narratives about this particular era of the church and illuminate some major fault lines that have been written about in ways that do not nuance the significance of what was happening both in the quorum under his leadership and in the broader policies of the church. But first, before I get into this, I want to put this in the context of what I study, because this is part of the reason why you have this lectureship. I am interested in no. I'm interested in people and groups who say no to the modern world and engage in certain practices, beliefs, and behaviors. I'm always interested in leadership and the members and how they negotiate the world and what boundaries will they uphold, which ones they will bend. I'm interested in how closed groups navigate what it means to be American or not, what it means to be a person of faith or not, and how that governs or not civic engagement. And foundationally, I'm interested in the question of race. How do people understand it and deploy it in their belief systems in order to shore up their particular beliefs? In reading Confidence and Change, questions came to me. What were the serious issues that McKay and the Quorum and the church at large had to deal with during this time period? How did they interact on these issues internally and externally? Were these issues similar to what high-boundary, closed religious groups of the time period, like Pentecostals and others, were going through? And at the core, was modernity either changing the church or making it become more rigid? Most important to me, and this is the dangerous one, what work did Revelation do for the denominational leadership in a time of change? My lecture is going to be about all of these things through the lens of looking at two big topical issues: the outer world, defined by the political and social mores of the time, and the interior world, the private world of everyday lives and marriage and families, and how these issues were either being prosecuted by the Quorum or being buffeted and challenged during this time of tremendous change in America. So at the outset of this talk, I want to clearly lay out three things I want to deal with during the time we have today. First, Mormons are becoming model Americans by engaging the modern world through political activity, capitalism, and education, and respectability. There is a case to be made, I think, for usurping Billy Graham and a whole coterie of evangelicals from his hallowed perch as the confider to presidents, and instead to focus on the relationship and outreach that David O. McKay and other members of the church had with presidents and church members who were politicians during this time period. I believe that the church rivaled the moves of evangelicals much earlier than we have talked about in American religion to be involved in politics, and that their problems early on in Washington were replaced this time with a conduit to not only the three branches of government, but to the FBI as well. Second, LDS leadership was grappling with similar issues that other denominations were facing during this time period, such as civil rights, gender, communism, and other major societal changes. And the pressure of these issues clashed with their desire to continue the project that Paul Reeve describes in his book, Religion of a Different Color, to paraphrase, that Mormons were about the project to become more white, and in my thinking during this time period, more white Anglo-Saxon Protestant slash evangelical. And as he points out so perceptively, that whiteness equaled access to political, social, and economic power. So in a way, I'd say that titling the book Confidence Amid Change is not exactly the perfect title. Confidence Amidst a Gathering Storm might be more apt. The third, which I will speak about briefly, but you'll have to wait actually till the journal article comes out to get the real meat of this argument, is that modernism presents a serious challenge to LDS theology on the topic of revelation. Revelation, as we can see in these minutes, isn't merely just God-given. It is about how to navigate denominational politics, theologies, and personalities in such a way that when revelation is invoked, it has the maximum effect and effect desired. And I will give you an example of this. In the Pentecostal world, when you talk about this, you say, God told me to tell you this. And that holds, because basically you can't really say that God didn't tell somebody something. That would be to challenge their faith. And so in a way, revelation is working in a similar kind of way here. Revelation is deployed as a deterrent to behaviors and a deterrent to changing policy, because to quote McKay, until we get a revelation, there can be no changes to church policy. Revelation is a shield. It is a shield against an encroaching world, but one that is also being eroded by the world. And so what I mean by that, essentially, is to say, is this. Revelation is the thing that you can both invoke to continue on the traditions of the church, but it is also the thing that you invoke to keep those traditions from not changing. It is a way to be able to say, we're not going to change in a modern world. But those are the things that are bumping up against modernism during this time period. And so the project of becoming more modern is always being stymied by the effects of what you want to have done with Revelation and where you want to keep the church in certain kinds of practices and beliefs. And so that's the tension I want to talk about today. But before we can get to that tension, we have to talk about what you're doing in order to make the church more modern. And I want to start off with a quote from McKay from October 5th, 1952. In view of the coming election, and in order to refute false statements that are being made regarding the views of the general authorities pertaining to candidates of political parties, I made a definite statement that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its leaders are nonpartisan and favor neither political party or candidate during the forthcoming election. Now, this is a great statement, but it's not quite true. And what I mean by it not being quite true is that it's not quite true in the sense that McKay is a staunch Republican and he knows exactly where he's standing. And I start off with this because what I feel that is very interesting about the church during this time period is that at the same time that Billy Graham is beginning to make inroads into politics, and in the very next year, in this year, he's going to be working on doing the prayer, the National Day of Prayer, and all these kinds of things. Meanwhile, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is doing something entirely different. And so the first thing is BYU. Truman shows up in 1952. And he's there to give a speech, which is highly taught out and everything. And then the next thing we see is that McKay is attending the inauguration of Dwight D. Eisenhower. He remarked that day on the dense fog that clouded D.C., and this is from the minutes, "I remarked to Sister McKay and my friends that this fog is typical of the fog that has been hanging over Washington politically for 20 years. He remarks that some in the group did not smile, evidently they were Democrats, and sympathetic to Roosevelt Truman administration. It seemed to me, however, to be an apt comparison." Now, Eisenhower is going to show up a little bit later in this talk in a completely different way, but for this particular time period, everybody likes Eisenhower. They like Eisenhower for a couple of reasons. One is that he appoints someone in the church to be his agriculture secretary, Ezra Taft Benson. And as we know, Benson is going to have a little problem about this later on with Eisenhower. So it's nice to be in a crowd that knows what's coming, okay? Anyway, but that next year, he ended up, McKay, going to a dinner at the White House. He was very honored, and part of the minutes say this. "Just before we took our seats, President Eisenhower came up to me and said, 'President McKay, your seat is opposite mine, and before we take our seats, I should like to have you say grace.'" This is May 9th, 1955. McKay goes on in the minutes that Middlemiss writes to say that he gets a whole tour of the White House. He's shown the Lincoln bedroom, all of these things, and that he is very close and with that time Ezra Taft Benson. Now, I mention these things because already we see that there's a closeness to the proximity of power. Here we have a picture of McKay here with Richard Nixon. This is from the Getty collection right here, sitting in the offices, and that's from the Life Images collection. This goes on for the entire time. For almost all of his presidential career, he is shown with other presidents. And particularly this picture got to me, JFK at the Mormon Tabernacle, September 26, 1963, because this is a few weeks before his assassination. Now, why this picture intrigues me is two reasons. One is we could see from the minutes that McKay has some problems with Catholics. He didn't like them. Didn't like them very much at all. But he is very gracious to John F. Kennedy when he comes to Salt Lake City. And the speech that he gives at the Mormon Tabernacle, he would later replay for Robert Kennedy when he comes also a few weeks before he is assassinated and shows him some various artifacts from that particular time period. Now, you're probably wondering, why am I going through this about presidents first? Because I need to set a foundation. The church is not some backwater church during this time period.
You are engaging with presidents. And the kinds of things that you're doing right now are not happening in other denominations. It's happening with you. And people are coming to Utah. There's a whole host of other people who come to Utah. And you also have a good number of the members of the church who are also state Senate positions and the National Senate and in others. And so part of this has to do with setting up a foundation about what you think you're supposed to be as American. And having this place where you have come out of the rest of where you left America in order to do what you needed to do as a church now has turned around into this very interesting courtship between the church and presidential figures. I think it's the first way in which we can see that the church is trying to establish itself as a different kind of entity in the middle part of the 20th century. But there's another reason why they wanted to do this, and that is because of the threat of communism. This is McKay from 1958. I look upon communism as an enemy whose sole purpose is the destruction of capitalism and our form of government, and that the use of wiretapping is justifiable in preserving our government. Now, this is a conversation that he's having with a representative from the FBI that has come to visit. And this is important because basically what it says is it sets up a kind of dichotomy about how the church thinks about communism. All churches are thinking about communism at the same time in much the same manner, in part because communism was seen as a threat to Christianity. It was supplant Christianity in a certain kind of way, and people went to great lengths in order to fight it. One of the more interesting stories to me is an evangelical by the name of Billy Ray Hargis, who actually gets permission from the government to fly balloons with tracks over into the Soviet Union so that he can try to proselytize and get people away from communism. It doesn't really work, but you know, the balloons get a little bit over the border, but not very much. Even black churches during this time period are speaking out against communism. The church that I write about in my early book, Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, the women's department of the Church of God in Christ has every year a statement against communism written in their convention books. So communism is a big thing to fight. But this internal conversation about communism becomes very important. Let me read you a quote from June 3rd, 1954, where McKay talks about communism. It's more apparent than ever, becoming more apparent each day, that the two great organized forces, the purpose of which is to undermine the high principles of the restored gospel, are operating. One is communism, which is moving aggressively over the face of the earth, fundamentally prompted by disbelief in the existence of God, a rejection of the life of Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world, and is against the church. The other, can you guess, is the Catholic Church, which is showing more clearly than ever that they are determined to counteract the influence of the church in this Western country. Now, people are opposed to the Catholic Church today for a lot of different reasons and a lot of reasons that are actually good ones. But at the same time, during this time, there's a great fear about what the papacy is doing and if the papacy is going to take over things. But as a sidebar, what is interesting to me is that the Catholic Church is about to go through the same kind of upheaval that is going to happen in your church. But Catholicism is a menace to Protestantism. And with that, there's a problem, because we have to figure out, are we going to let these kind of people come into the country or not? So the senator at the time, who's also LDS, Senator Arthur Watkins, meets with McKay and talks to him in 1953 about a special immigration bill in the country that was to allow 240,000 people into the country of U.S., Dutch, German, and Italian descent in order to aid against the war of communism. This was how it was posited, because these people would be more likely to be effective against the communist threat that the country felt that they had. Of the 240,000, 75,000 Italians would be allowed in. McKay responded by saying he didn't feel too well about the Italians, but that he felt all right about the Dutch and Germans. So this bias kind of continues all throughout the minutes, and I'm interested in the ways in which Italians get colored a kind of a way, and Negroes are talked about in a similar way, but we'll get to that in a minute. Now, this fight against communism, everybody will probably recognize this face. Now, I have something to admit to you all before we get started with this and before I continue to read. I didn't know anything about Cleom Skousen until Glenn Beck. So if you're going to blame anybody for getting Cleom Skousen out there again, where he had been kind of underneath things, you blame him. Because once he started talking about him, when he got on his Fox News show and I was doing research on Sarah Palin and other people, I was like, who is this guy? I don't know who he is. But it appeared to me very quickly that he's a very important person, because basically he's someone who has a very big hold, not only on the church, but in a way on Ezra Taft Benson. He's a Canadian transplant that Hoover considered to be so right-wing that even the FBI surveilled him, even though he worked for the Bureau from 1935 to 1951. So if they don't like him, you can know that that's a problem already. They think he's dangerous. And if J. Edgar Hoover thinks somebody white is dangerous, you're dangerous. It's true. Now, it's interesting. I'm sorry. It's true. I'm just, you know, having read some of these minutes, it's the truth. Okay. But Skousen's really interesting. He's not only just teaching at BYU, I looked in the improvement era and I see these monthly things that he writes about family and psychology and how to teach your kids. And he sounded a little bit to me, if you take him out of this communist context, the modern day counterpart to me would be like a Focus on the Family person. But he seems to be very benign there. But when you start to look at these other things, it becomes very interesting. He was convinced that there was a vast communist conspiracy. And his first book, The Naked Communist, that you see here, that's covered in right parts, right, was that book. Most people now know him for the book that he writes in 1980, The 5,000-Year Leap. But during McKay's presidency, he becomes the source of tension between McKay and Everett Taft Benson and his son Reed Benson, who embraced much of Skousen's beliefs, plus the beliefs of the John Birch Society. And let me just say something here for a minute. All of this material is going everywhere during this time period. It is in Protestant churches. Some of it is actually in Catholic churches. It's the reason why we get to later, when you get to John Paul II, that he is so vehemently against communism, and he crushes Latin American liberation theology. All of this stuff and the fear of communism is always there, and it's still here today. When you hear people say the word socialism, this is the word that they're actually talking about. Okay, so just to kind of give you a framework about how these things continue over historically, okay? Now, the other person who becomes a very interesting part of this story for McKay and others is Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society. Now, I know Robert Welch in a completely different way. I like the candy that he created, okay? So if you think about all the chocolates and everything else, that's a really sweet taste, but there's another taste to go along with this altogether from sugar babies. The John Birch Society was formed in December of 1958 along with 9 other millionaires that met for 2 days in order to agree to this one purpose: to root out communists opposed to the United Nations, the opposition to the civil rights movement, and lastly, to Dwight Eisenhower, who they believe was a dedicated agent of the communist conspiracy. And what would end up happening, what you see in the memorandum on this side, is actually the subject, Ezra Taft Benson, former Secretary of Agriculture, where this is from the FBI in 1962, that there had a call from Secretary Benson, and basically he starts to talk about this John Birch Society and the communist threat, and that how can he be of help to them. And so actually Ezra Taft Benson also has an FBI file, not as great as, you know, Skousen's, but it's there. Okay. Basically, there's this dilemma, and the church is having to face this. And the dilemma is, how much are we going to allow these outside societies to come in and be able to talk to the members of the church? So there's a lot of stuff in the minutes that McKay shows that we need to think about how we're going to talk about communism. And I want to read one of these things. He says, in this connection, however, we must be careful about condemning any efforts that are anti-communistic, because communism is a real danger in our country. It is a termite movement, the purpose of which is to make the state dominant over the individual. Our sacrament meetings should be reserved for spiritual enrichment and spiritual instruction. Now, why did he have to say something like this? Well, one of the reasons why he had to say something like this is because a lot of the John Birch Society people are recruiting within sacrament meetings. And this is coming back to McKay, and they're having very serious discussions about this from about 1959 forward. This almost pops up every year about what are we going to do, because somebody wants to put something in a sacrament meeting, and they want to talk about anti-communism, or they want somebody to join a society. And so part of this is Ezra Taft Benson is really pushing for this and wanting people to do it. And one of the things that came up was they wanted to show a movie. And I want to show this right now to you, and hopefully I'm going to get this right. I have an assistant. This is nice. Say hello to everybody. because it won't play my thing. So we're going to show you a little clip of this movie, and I'll talk about it.
Is this the Nazis invading Poland? Is it the Japanese attack on Manchuria? No. This is a United Nations peacekeeping force making war on the men, women, and children of Katanga. What was their crime? Like the 46 other countries that have gained independence since the end of World War II, Katanga, a portion of the Belgian Congo, wanted to be free and independent. But Katanga made the mistake of being pro-Western, pro-Christian, and pro-free enterprise. Why does an organization ostensibly formed for the purpose of keeping peace make war? That is the real story behind the humanity.
I'm going to stop it right there. This was a John Birch Society movie that you see the date up there says 1966, but it's actually made a little bit earlier in 1963. It was redistributed in 1966. And one of the Tampa wards asked if they were able to show this, and this shows up in the minutes with McKay, and he says basically we have to quit using these outside materials. I want to make a big statement about communism, but we cannot continue to use these kinds of materials. But it's instructive to see this because I think it links to a deeper question about how the church is really right alongside other churches, and especially evangelicals during this time period. The first thing you heard is the United Nations is basically communism. Now, this is part of the issue that is happening when the United Nations is formed. The National Council of Churches is really behind it and for it. Other churches are not because they think it's the one world government. It plays into evangelical roles about what the end of the world is supposed to become, and that a one world government is a thing that everybody is so afraid of. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was afraid of this because it's also about having the government rule over you instead of the church ruling over its members. And so there's a real tension in the minutes where communism shows up over, I think, about almost 400 times within this whole book of 800-something pages, that they have to talk about how we're going to deal with this, but at the same time keep members from going forward and joining all of these societies. There's a real tension between, do you join the John Birch Society, do you do all these other things? The other thing I found very interesting about this in the minutes that I didn't see anything of is that there's no talk about some of the other things that are really evangelicals are looking at during this time period. One thing that I think is very interesting that you don't talk about is the role of prayer in schools. Everyone is talking about this issue as a way that communism is coming to the schools. This does not show up anywhere in McKay's minutes, and I think one of the reasons why it doesn't is because you already got prayer in school anyway, so it doesn't really matter. This is Utah, after all. So nobody has to really worry about this because it makes a difference, because if you run everything, you don't have to think about it in that kind of a way. So, but there's another thing about communism that becomes really and clearly apparent during this time period, and that is that communism is linked directly with the civil rights movement. And what happens with this is that at the beginning, when Martin Luther King begins to do the Montgomery bus boycott and all of these other things, that communism is the thing that is laid upon the civil rights movement because it's calling for two things. One is calling for equality for African Americans, but it also calls for economic equality. And that is something that I see in the minutes that McKay is very worried about. What are we going to do with these African Americans? How are we going to, and he calls them Negroes, obviously. Oops, did I mess it up? How are we going to deal with them? And how do we deal with them in certain kinds of situations? One whole chapter of this volume of minutes is devoted to something that I think is a very interesting issue, an issue that I want to talk about in a brief way here, but I think one that is important because it shows the way and the manner in which race is thought of in the church during this time period, and that is about that. But before we get there, I want to show you one more thing. Let's see if it's going to go. Why am I not going? Maybe I'm in the wrong spot. Try that. Nope. Let me get to the next one. All right, there we go. Before we get there, though, we've got to deal with the problem of Ezra Taft Benson. Now, this is too long for today, but I thought I would deal with the last two things that I think are most interesting. and that is that Ezra Taft Benson has a desire at the same time that someone else in the church has a desire, and we'll talk about him in a minute, to run for president. Now I'll read this to you if you can't see it. Wallace's Veep. George Wallace has approached Ezra Taft Benson, former Secretary of Agriculture, to be his running mate. Benson has become the darling of the John Birch Society ever since he left the Eisenhower candidate. As a Mormon apostle, he discussed Wallace's offer with the church leaders, 92-year-old David O. McKay, who strongly advised him not to accept. Benson's flirtation with the far right has been an embarrassment to the Mormon church. This is a Utah paper, by the way. Now, this is a very short, brief article. In the minutes, this is not a short, brief thing at all. And it is very intense because basically Ezra Taft Benson wants this opportunity to run for president. First, he says he wants to run for president and he wants the permission of the church to do so. He is told that he cannot. Then the talk becomes he wants to be vice president, and then he gets told he cannot. And so this becomes a real point of contention between him and David O. McKay, and he ends up being sent away as that. Now, I will go into this more in the Journal article because it's very intricate, but part of the arguments and part of the minutes that are shown tells me a couple of things. One is that this started off to be a nice relationship, but it became very contentious. Part of the contention was about his outside work with the John Birch Society. Part of it was about his son, Reed. But part of it is also this desire to be a part of this burgeoning movement where he sees it going across the country. Now, the book on the other side you see, which is The Severed Head of a Black Man, is The Black Hammer, a study of black power, red influence, and white alternatives. There was a sense in which everybody thought that the communist movement had infiltrated civil rights, and this was one of the things that Hoover really looked for and in his surveillance. And I don't know if any of you have seen the recent piece on Martin Luther King and FBI surveillance, but it's really important to remember that the FBI is about two different things during this time period. One is to keep law and order, but the other thing is to surveil people that J. Edgar Hoover doesn't like. So part of this is about also the ways in which Ezra Taft Benson is with a part of the contingent of the church really against civil rights and the civil rights movement. But then you have other members of the church who are trying to do things a little bit differently. This is a picture of George Romney sitting in the back of a convertible with some young African-American women. We don't have a date on this, unfortunately, but this is out of the University of Michigan George Romney collection. George Romney also wants to run for president in 1968, and he is the choice of the church, obviously, because that is a person who seems to be a little more palatable in certain kinds of ways. I picked Romney because I think one of the things that's interesting about his particular case is that he is caught in a dilemma when he starts to run for governor back in the early 1960s. He asked McKay what to do because he's running for governor of Michigan. Detroit is a large African-American population during the time period, and he's saying, how are we going to deal with this issue of marriage? If there is no intermarriage, then what am I going to be able to say to people? What can I say to them? And there's a lot of hedging that happens in the minutes about what you should say and what you shouldn't say. And so part of it is about, oh, we need to figure out what are we going to do. And so let me read these two quotes, and I want to start to talk about and move into this section about what happens with the interior world. The fact is that we do not welcome Negroes into our social affairs because if we did, it would lead to intermarriage, and we do not favor intermarriage. We recommend that Negroes marry Negroes and that whites marry whites, and we cannot modify that statement. We object to Negroes marrying whites for their own happiness. Thank you. Since I'm not married, you know, I'm happy that somebody's trying to figure out what my happiness is supposed to be. I said that we cannot change our attitude until we receive a revelation, here's revelation, from the Lord or directing otherwise. David O. McKay, September 26, 1951. But the money quote for me is the last one. I think they should remain where they are, and this was in relationship to Nigeria, to urge marriage among their own kind. The thought of intermarriage bothers me more than anything. And that is the truth. Because that is the thing that he gets more, I would say, to use a popular term from kids, hype than anything else. Now, the way that McKay talks about race is from a 19th century kind of viewpoint about the hierarchy of races. He sees himself as being the person who thinks about this, and the Negro is in a certain kind of a place, and that what are we going to do when this starts to encroach upon the church? So one story that comes out in the minutes is a message from Senator Udall that 500 Negro families are coming to the Tool Ordination Depot, and that are these families going to be invited to attend Mormon social gatherings, Mormon churches, and the community swimming pool. McKay says in the minutes that it will be up to the community of Toole to accept them or not, but the church will accept them to baptism, but not the priesthood. They're not invited to social affairs because that would lead to intermarriage. Now, this is always the place that he goes. It doesn't matter if you're going to have a Negro coming somewhere or if somebody going to come and sing at the tabernacle. It always comes back to this question of race mixing or intermarriage. And that says something to me very different than what you might think I'm going to say to you. It's not about black people. It's about you. It's about whiteness and Mormonism. It's about a continuation of trying to keep up what Paul Reeve talks about leaving this way of looking at Mormons behind and coming into the mainstream of white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. In a conversation with George Romney this same year, in regards to his candidacy for the governor of Michigan, McKay again reiterates his position. We can offer them, Negroes, any other thing that the church can offer, and we do advocate care and marriage. We advocate that Mexicans marry Mexicans, Japanese marry Japanese, Catholics marry Catholics, and Mormons marry Mormons for the good of family harmony and peace. We look with hesitancy, and one might say, suspicion on our church allowing Negroes, Chinese, Japanese, Hawaiians to mingle with each other. That, of course, would encourage marriage. Now, I don't know why mingling encourages marriage, but okay. It's hard, and I'll come to a story here at the end, which will sort of illuminate that for you very, very clearly. But there's a bigger problem. And here's the problem of a growing church that is in the world during this time period, making tremendous strides in places like Brazil, New Zealand, and other places that have different kinds of ethnic groups. Who do you let in? Who do you not let in? Well, one particular ethnic group that you never let in is somebody who's African. Now, this is a picture of Nigerian Mormons with a Mormon lady, Peggy Hansen, in 1996 in Alba, Nigeria. She's also a Peace Corps volunteer. That's how she ends up there. Okay, so it's not their church, Peace Corps. Okay? Now, this engenders a huge conversation, which is a whole chapter in this text. And part of the conversation is about what do we do? There are people in Nigeria who have figured out that they want to be a part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They can't get to the priesthood. They don't have anybody. So can we send someone to talk to them? And this becomes a major issue for McKay. Because McKay wants to do this, but he doesn't want to give them anything. So there's a big conversation. One conversation is, do we give them the Aaronic priesthood or not? You know what the answer is. No. Okay? So that's not going to happen. Second is, who do we send? Now, the problem with sending someone is that somebody aptly brings up the fact that, well, the Nigerians have already put the British out. Why would they want to have white people run things again? Why would you bring a white couple in? But McKay's we're still worried again about intermarriage. And so his way to deal with this is that we're going to send in married couples, those who don't have children or their children are older, so that we don't have to deal with this. And we might send a couple of single men, but we're not going to do this. But we want to keep the Nigerians in Nigeria as much as possible. Now, at the same time, you have Nigerians that are here at BYU, a small contingent of them. And this is bothering everybody because they're afraid that they're going to start dating white girls. So what is the other fear? The other fear is black men with white women. And this is the fear that's not just the LDS fear, it's a fear across the nation. Because this comes out of the 19th century ways of thinking about black men as bestial, black men as rapists, and that all gets sort of constructed in the part of the Reconstruction period. So in a sense, there's these tensions. There's a tension of we have people in the church, we want to be able to bring them in, but how are we going to deal with this? And meanwhile, we got a white woman sitting with a bunch of unbaptized Nigerian Mormons who's particularly just fine. And so these are the contradictions in the church. These are the places where the contradictions are happening, and I'll talk about one big contradiction at the end. But this is where morality becomes an issue, and morality becomes an issue because it's a sense in which people are going to have to deal with the modern world. Because the church is expanding, you're explaining to places that race is not constructed as the one-drop rule in America. In America, if you have one drop of black blood, you're black. In other places, if you have one drop of something else, you're something else. Okay, so in South Africa, if you've got one drop of white blood, you're not a Zulu or a Xhosa. You're colored if we use the old appellations for this. So this becomes very confusing, but they're still holding to the way Americans look at race. And so this becomes problematic. So you see stories throughout this text about, oh, we found somebody who we think has Negro blood. Do we take them off the roll? Now, what's interesting about McKay is he says, no, we can't prove it, so don't take them off the rolls. We can't take them out. But this question of who has Negro blood and who doesn't begins to really bedevil the church. And have to think about this in ways when you go to a place like Brazil that has a mestizo population and others, what do we do? We don't know what we do. But that's not the only problem. The other problem is about how do we take care of something that's part of our theology, and that's the family. And so that becomes a major issue within the church. And as early as 1953, there are certain things that get to be talked about. And one of those is about contraception. And I picked this one because I think this is very interesting because it dovetails in. And I want to show you a couple of pages of the improvement era while I talk about this. Contraception is very interesting for a couple of reasons. One is because you're bringing in, obviously, children into the world that are spirit bodies that are coming to be here on earth, right? So the conversation about contraception very early on is one about two things. One is, how are we going to stop our students at BYU from using it? Yeah, that's right. They're using it. I know it's shocking. It's true. During this time period, they are thinking about it. And second is, how do we talk about people who have too many kids and that women are tired? So we see this quote in September 23rd, 1953. Dr. Edward McKay recalled regarding contraceptives and the church's stand toward their use. I told him that the church cannot countenance contraceptives. Marriage is for the purpose of having children and rearing a family. If a couple makes modification of this, the responsibility is theirs, but they do not have the church's sanction in the use of contraceptives and the delaying of having children. Now, this comes on the heels of also something that becomes very troubling, and that is the amount of people who want to have their marriages unsealed at the temple. And this is something that McKay starts to handle himself in 1958 and 59, but by the time this happens, he becomes very dismayed about these unsealings, and he gives this away to other people within the church to do it because he can't stand to see this. The other part is that he has later on in the 60s, a gynecologist from Salt Lake that comes to speak to him to ask, what should I do about people who want to use contraception in the church? Because I now realize what I've told women who have had several children, who think that they are tired of having children, not to go ahead and use it, and that's okay, but I think I'm a bad Mormon now because I'm telling them to do this. And McKay says to him that basically you shouldn't do that, and what you should do is counsel to men to withhold themselves, which I thought was very interesting. Instead of telling the woman to use contraception, he's saying men have to refrain. So ponder that for a minute. That's why I say this is interesting. The other thing about women, and obviously this gets to Claire Middlemiss, and I'm coming down towards the end because we're getting close to time. The other thing that gets to be very interesting about this is, what do you do about working women? And this becomes a real issue because you have single women around. And single women can work and they can do certain kinds of things, but once they get married, there's something else. So in the first presidency meeting of June 15, 1962, among many items considered was a letter from the general superintendency of the Sunday school relating to six young women in the employ of the Sunday school board since they have been married. I have said that the policy restricting the employment of married women have not been followed as it should be. I reviewed practices which involved the office of the first presidency as well as other departments. I referred also to special employment problems in the genealogical society. I stated that the rule is honored more in the breach than in observance, and mentioned the change of practices over the practices of many years ago, which in other words, like, we're already changing. I don't like it. The advisability of revising the regulation was carefully considered, and it was decided that women will be hired and retained after marriage if they are capable and do their work well, but it will be expected that they will not deliberately postpone responsibilities of parenthood. This also dovetails into the ideas about birth control. How does this square up with everybody else? One way this squares up with everybody else is that you're going to have a raging battle in the Catholic Church during the time of Vatican II about whether or not to do birth control. The Catholic Church decides that it does not want to have birth control. Okay? Now, this will change for LDS later on, but during this time period, they are wrestling with the same issues. They're wrestling with the issues of divorce. They're wrestling with basically students at BYU who are having sex before they are married. What are we going to do about these fallen girls, right? And that's what they get called in the text. The other thing that's very interesting, and I'll just touch on this very briefly before I get down to the conclusion, is about adoption. What do you do about adoption? And adoption comes up in two interesting ways in the text. One way it comes up is about a couple, an LDS couple who are dating. They get pregnant. They don't want to be married to each other. And the families come together and say, what can we do about this? McKay counsels that they should get married. He doesn't want them not to get married. But they decide not to get married. And then he says, but I want that baby to be adopted into a Mormon family, because it shouldn't be outside of the camp. If it's a Mormon child, it should be with a Mormon family. So that's number one. The second is, later on, a doctor here in Salt Lake, about 1966, 67, asked if he might be able to adopt two young black boys. He is told no, because they're black. So there's a question about adoption. Can you adopt someone who's outside of your particular race? Can you, if you get pregnant, give that child away to a non-Mormon family? These things are unclear, but McKay is weighing in on them, I think, because of his fears about what happens to Mormon families. And so this is where I come down to the conclusion, and I'm going to close very quickly here. This desire for modernity also yields something that McKay clearly is having happen to him in the text, and that is fear. Is the fear of change. Now, obviously, his health does not hold up during this time period, and that with all of these issues that are besetting him, it falls to Clara Middlemiss and other members of the quorum to make some decisions about what gets done. And for the most part, they are holding the line, but the line is beginning to break. And that line, you can see as we go forward in the minutes, that things become a little frayed. And that these issues of morality are also pressing against the bigger issues about what's going on in the denomination. So I think there's several things to think about. One is, how is morality choking off the chance of getting anything to move forward and to take the place that you want to take in modern society, but still holding on to the same tenets of Mormonism? That's number one. Number two is, this issue of race is the undercurrent of almost everything that is happening. You can't get away from it. You can't get away from the fact that it's not just about banning the Negro. It's about our place in the world as white Christians. And I put it like that in quotation marks. And what does it mean if we're not wholly white anymore? And who do we accept and who we don't? Later on, you're going to figure out who are the people that belong in certain kinds of places. And so when Latin America opens up, obviously that changes the way you think about things in terms of who, you know, the natives are, the Lamanites are. Right? It changes everything. And so this time period, I think, needs to be looked at not just for the fact that it seems to be a time of growth, great growth and expansion of the church, but it's a time in which, and that is the end for me, where revelation gets used as a shield. Every time he talks about the Negro in this text, the word revelation comes up. And revelation is used to push back against something. It's barely used with anything else. And so my question, as we close with this, is what happens when everything changes? And let's get down to the last thing I want to talk about very quickly. Interracial marriage. I have a secret. I love the wedding page in the New York Times. And so I got up one Sunday morning last year, and I saw this couple. Now, this struck me for two reasons. One, they got married in Houston, Texas, my hometown. And the second is, it's a white LDS guy with a black LDS woman. And they told the story of how they met on a Mormon dating app, which is great. And her parents aren't Mormon, and all the things that they have to go through to explain it and everything. And so now here comes the testimony part. Thursday afternoon, when I'm on my way here, I'm in Denver Airport, and I'm standing in line for Southwest Airlines. And there's a very nice woman in front of me. I won't tell you her real name. I'm going to call her B. So B says to me, how are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And we remark about the woman at the gate who's being very stringent about all the bags. And I'm thinking, okay, this is interesting. So she said, oh, are you going to Salt Lake? I said, yes, I'm going to Salt Lake. I'm going to go give a talk. I'm going to the Mormon Historical Association. She goes, are you Mormon? And I said, no. And I know you're not supposed to use that word, but I'm not Mormon, so it's okay. I'm sorry. Historians are never going to stop using this word, okay? Sorry. We're just not going to stop. All right, and I know what he's trying to do, but again, even not using that word is about the process of trying to mainstream yourself, okay? Just, you know, I don't mean to be polemical, I'm just saying, this is what it is. So she asked me if I was. I said, no, but I've been really interested in Mormons, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, I'm kind of going to give a talk, and I hope it's going to be received well. But, you know, she said, oh, so I said, are you married? She said, no, my husband died 10 years ago. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. She said, but he was black. And I went, whoop. There's a story here, right? And so I say to her, really? When did you get married to him? Obviously, she's white. And I said, when did you get married to him? She said, 1995. And she said, well, I had a first husband, but he wasn't very nice to me. And he, you know, that was code for probably abusive. And he drank a lot. And I had my children with him. I had six kids. And, you know, but I met this man and he was really lovely. And I decided I wanted to get married. And some of my children were really upset about it. And when I told my mother, she said to me, you can't bring a black man into my house. And then the next question was, how black is he? I went, you know, I wasn't even mad about that because there would be black people who would ask that same question. And that's the problem with race, right? Because we have these kind of things that are going on in our head. And I thought, and I said to her, I said, well, you know, really bless you because I said, you must have really loved each other. She said, yeah, you know, he was a convert to the church and he came in and we were, you know, we had many happy years together, but he had some problems, diabetes and high blood pressure. And, you know, he was taken away from me too soon, but we had the time that we had together. And I know we're going to have time together again. And I thought, this is fantastic because that's where I want to end this story. That no matter what you think about what is going to be, that in the end, no matter what the rules are or anything else, people are what make up a church. They are the things that, you know, doctrine and laws and rules and everything else, love can't trump that. And so you have to start to consider where these things lodge in the sense of what you're trying to do as a denomination as a whole and how it affects people on the ground. And I think she was the best way for me to see that and to give you the end of the story. So thank you. Thank you so much.